Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. This week, we're revisiting an episode from earlier this year about LGBT issues across Appalachia. June is Pride Month, which means here in Appalachia and across the U.S., people are marching in parades and celebrating the rights of those who identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender. It's also a time to remember the 1969 Stonewall riots in New York City, when the LGBT community erupted over the police raid of a gay club. Those demonstrations are considered a pivotal moment in the country's gay liberation movement. The movement has made a lot of gains since then, such as the 2015 Supreme Court ruling in favor of gay marriage. And just this month, the World Health Organization said it will stop classifying being transgender as a mental illness. But there are still some troubling statistics, especially for LGBT youth. A survey out this month from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention revealed that young LGBT people are still struggling. Nearly two-thirds of lesbian, gay, or bisexual high schoolers say they had persistent feelings of sadness or hopelessness last year, and nearly half say they had seriously considered suicide. They were also significantly more likely to experience bullying and dating violence and to be threatened at school. The survey didn't explicitly mention transgender teens, but other studies have shown they face similar obstacles. Here in West Virginia, a group of LGBT teens have decided to unite, to give each other hope, and to have a good time. This past spring, these teens organized a prom for their LGBT classmates, the first of its kind in the state. Molly Bourne hung out with them as they got ready for the big dance, and she brings us this story.
No, stop! Steve Sarton ties the rainbow laces on his brand new Chuck Taylors, buttons his crisp white shirt, and snaps on rainbow suspenders.
I feel hot. Not like, oh my God, I'm burning up. I feel hot.
He says he's got butterflies.
I've never actually been to a dance with like others before, like in fact, like a big dance like this. And I'm kind of nervous that like I'm going to do something I'm going to embarrass myself. But like, I know deep down inside I'm not going to, but there's like so that little anxiety that's like pushing up against me. But it's going to go away.
Steve's not the only one who's nervous. Across the room, his friends are curling their hair and carefully applying makeup. They're all members of a new LGBT support group made up of students from Southern West Virginia. It's sponsored by the West Virginia chapter of the National Quaker Humanitarian Organization. Because these nine students come from at least three different counties, they've met to get ready at the organization's office, which is close to the formal. Steve is 15 years old. He's from Kermit in Mingo County, and he'll be a junior this fall. He came out to his parents last year, first as bisexual, then as gay.
Last year, I really was worried. I didn't know how they would react, but Mom was there and said that she would always love me no matter what, so that's all that matters.
Steve likes school. He plays clarinet in the Tug Valley High School band, and he says he loves living in the mountains. But growing up gay in Mingo County isn't easy. He says he and his LGBT friends get teased often.
You walk down the hallway and you can hear, well, look, there's that, the F word that we do not like, that I don't like personally.
Sam Green helped plan the Rainbow Formal, which is being held at West Virginia State University. He'll be a senior at Hurricane High School. Sam is trans, and while he says his school is an accepting place, not everyone at the dance can say the same. He says the Rainbow Formal is a place where everyone can be themselves.
So this is sort of like a place that they can go to be able to know that they'll have access to like a school dance, and so they don't have to worry about being bullied or anything.
Steve's friend Jasmine sits patiently as her mom makes ringlets in her mostly shaved ice blue hair and sets it with a blast of hairspray.
Sorry, I know you hate it.
Don't touch it.
Jasmine is a bright and soft-spoken senior from Boone County. 2 years ago, she came out as bisexual and now identifies as pansexual. That's a term used to describe people who are attracted to others regardless of their gender. She doesn't want us to use her last name because some members of her extended family don't know she's not straight. Her mom, Tiffany, is the only parent here, although all of the students needed to get signed permission forms to attend the formal. Tiffany says she always helps her daughter get ready for dances.
There's nowhere I would be other than here today, whether she's going to rainbow formal or traditional prom or marrying a man or marrying a woman or whatever. I'm going to be there.
Jasmine knows she has a fierce ally in her mother.
I feel very accepted and encouraged just to be myself.
Tiffany helps Jasmine lace up the corset she pairs with a bustle skirt, thigh highs, and mom's red heels, while her friends sing along to a song from the musical Avenue Q.
What you do in bed with guys?
Nikki, that's wrong.
No, it's not.
Once they're all ready, the teens board a 12-seat passenger van driven by the Quaker group's youth outreach coordinator. Freshman Liza Kelly serenades the group during the drive. The students hop off the bus and pose for pictures.
Come on now, tall and back, short in the front, gather together.
Inside the student union at West Virginia State, disco lights bounce around the room. Students line up at the photo booth with props, a pink lei, an oversized pair of glasses, and Mickey Mouse ears. Some hold hands on their way to get snacks. Others hang back and talk at tables. At the end of the night, a cascade of rainbow balloons falls over the crowd. This, the teens say, is a place where they feel they belong. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Molly Bourne.
Students from 10 West Virginia schools organized that event, and they plan to do it again next year. West Virginia is one of many states where legislators have not passed laws that would ban employment and housing discrimination, as well as discrimination in restaurants, hotels, parks, and other public places based on sexual orientation or gender identity. While LGBT rights advocates haven't been deterred in their efforts, they have adjusted their strategy. Dave Mistich found out more about the efforts to get safeguards in place at the municipal level.
West Virginia doesn't necessarily have a reputation for embracing diversity and championing equality. But Andrew Snyder says people who believe that West Virginia is a closed-minded place have got it all wrong. He's the executive director of Fairness West Virginia, a nonprofit advocacy group fighting for LGBT rights.
I think West Virginia is very different than what people nationally think of it. I think it's a very inclusive. I think it's a very, you know, just enormously giving and generous place.
For years, Fairness West Virginia has been advocating for a state law that would make it illegal to discriminate against people based on their sexual orientation or gender identity. But their efforts have failed to gain traction. Still, they've had some successes on the municipal level. Snyder says it hasn't always been easy. He says West Virginia still has pockets of intolerance.
It's an older population, so it still can be susceptible to the, you know, just really horrible manipulative fear tactics.
Fear tactics like conservative religious-based groups preaching about what they see as the sinfulness of LGBT rights and influencing elected officials. But those tactics don't work on everyone. Fairness worked with locals in Morgantown, and in October, the Morgantown City Council voted unanimously to expand its Human Rights Commission. The new ordinance provides legally enforceable protections for those who are discriminated against because of their sexual orientation or gender identity. Morgantown is the 11th municipality in West Virginia to provide such protections. But even with the addition of Morgantown, less than 10% of West Virginians are protected by LGBT non-discrimination ordinances. Gay rights activists are trying to increase that statistic, but they're facing headwinds, even at the municipal level. One city in West Virginia has already flat-out rejected an LGBT non-discrimination ordinance.
For a lot of us, I think it unmasked something that we didn't realize was happening in our city.
That's Jean Peters, a Parkersburg-area businesswoman who advocated for a non-discrimination ordinance, or NDO, in Parkersburg. The city council rejected the ordinance last August. She says, at one time, the city's gay community was thriving, but things changed.
Sure, we were aware the population had shrunk. We were aware that a lot of professional people had left the areas, plants closed. What I was not personally aware of was the fact that people had been moving here and setting up these churches with a clear agenda. And the NDO ran smack into their agenda.
Peters blames the failure of the NDO on the influence of The Rock, a Parkersburg church that, along with others, spent a lot of time and effort lobbying the council and preaching an LGBT message. In the months after the city council rejected the NDO, Peters and other people fighting for LGBT rights kept the pressure on local officials. But with the next election for city council still a couple years away, they decided to redirect their focus to a broader mission, making themselves recognized around town.
We had decided to do some more positive things in the community. Not that standing up for your rights isn't incredibly positive, but to take on some other activities and take some other actions and draw more, build more awareness and more community.
The group has resurrected Parkersburg Pride, a nonprofit aiming to sponsor events and programs that enrich the community and affirm the value of LGBT people. They're hosting a Pride picnic and setting up stands at local fairs and festivals to accomplish that goal. Peter says this change in focus has helped their community become more organized and also identify allies. LGBT activists hope that their efforts at the municipal level will rub off on state lawmakers. Andrew Snyder with Fairness West Virginia says state and local politics have a symbiotic relationship with one another.
I would say in large part the struggle that we experienced in the legislature that helped to fuel our fight in the communities. And then in turn, it's going to be the progress and success that we've had in the communities that will help to fuel ultimately our success in passing LGBT non-discrimination law in the legislature.
Snyder says Fairness West Virginia is organizing other local non-discrimination campaigns and that they'll be the state legislature when the next session rolls around in January. Hopefully, he says, there will be more cities and towns who will have voted in favor of non-discrimination by then. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Dave Mistich.
I was born here just the same as you. Another time, another day. I'm sure the good Lord took his time, made each of us just this way. I walk beside you step by step, and it never crossed my mind that I would grow up one of the different kind. That didn't stop me from chopping the wood, scraping my knees like all boys should. Going down to the creek in the noonday sun, wringing out my shirt when the work got done.
First things first, I'm a blue-collar man. The scars on my knuckles, dust on my hands. Probably wouldn't have ever known I've got a man waiting on me at home. To tell you the truth, I don't want to fight. I just want to say one thing out right to you. Ain't we flesh and blood all through? And ain't we brothers too?
That was Sam Gleaves. He's a singer-songwriter from Berea, Kentucky, who grew up in rural Southwest Virginia. Gleaves is gay, and he was inspired to write that song after learning about a former coal miner who was harassed and threatened at work for being gay. Gleaves spoke with Roxy Todd in 2015.
I wanted to write the song about what it means to be a man. LGBTQ folks in Appalachia have a particularly complex identity because there's modern queer culture, which is very urban-centered and very young feeling in a lot of ways. And then there's what we think about Appalachian culture having deep roots, you know, and being rural and having gender roles that a lot of us feel restricted by. But then you have people that belong to both of those identities, like as a gay man who grew up in Southwest Virginia, I have to claim my whole self.
We asked LGBT Appalachians to tell us about their experiences growing up and living in our region. Here are three people we heard from.
Hi, I'm Erin. I'm from a small town outside of Asheville, North Carolina, and I knew I was gay when I was in the seventh grade. My mom was not very accepting at all. She trapped me in the car and yelled at me for a while, and finally I got out. I remember it was in January or February. It was snowing, and I was coming back from work, so I was just wearing like a light sweater. I ended up just walking home. Well, I got halfway, and then I just couldn't handle it, and I kind of sat on the ground behind a screen of trees, just in the snow. When I finally got someone on the phone, it was a family that took me in. You know, they picked me up and took me to their house. I remember they fed me that Faye or whatever yogurt with the little side thing with the jelly in it. I don't even like yogurt, but I love that stuff because that's what it reminds me of, just of their, you know, their warmth and their kindness to me. But things got better with my mom. You know, we're very close now, and she's accepting now. My whole family is.
Hi, my name is Casey, and I'm originally from Berkeley County, but I currently live in Monongalia County. I have been bisexual for as long as I can remember. I don't remember a time where I had to think about coming out to my parents. And I think a part of that was the fact that both of my parents are very open-minded people, and that both of my godparents are a gay man and a lesbian woman. I never really noticed any kind of discrimination or anything until I moved to North Central West Virginia. And really, that was when I started noticing that there was a bit of a fear of the queer community. And the older I get, the more I realize how important it is for people to understand that bisexuality is a legitimate sexual orientation. It's very important for me that people realize that while bisexuality can be a transitional phase, it can also be a stopping point.
My name is John. I am 59 years old, and I am a gay senior citizen, although I really prefer the term old school queer. I was born gay. I've always known it. My family has always known it. And while it's something that was by no means celebrated, I was never made to feel as though it was something bad or wrong. I grew up in Lewis County in what can only be described as an insanely normal childhood, homosexually speaking. Again, my friends knew there was something different about me, but it was never really acknowledged in any way. We just hung out and did all the things that a group of friends do. So my advice to families and communities is to accept and love all the people around you who are different in any way. I have known too many queer folk who have lived absolutely horrible lives, and it just doesn't have to be that way.
That was Aaron from North Carolina and Casey and John from West Virginia. Navigating healthcare can be a challenge for transgender people. According to a poll conducted late last year by NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, 10% of transgender people said they had been personally discriminated against when going to a doctor or health clinic. And just over 20% said they didn't seek out healthcare out of fear of discrimination. For people in rural areas, it can be even more difficult. Andrew Schneider of Fairness West Virginia says the transgender people he talks to have to go to Pittsburgh or Columbus or another major city hours away for basic healthcare needs. Journalist Rachel Geringer interviewed a gendered nonconforming Appalachian dealing with healthcare access and identity for her multimedia documentary project, Country Queers. She's also a reporter at WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky. Here is part of that interview with Kenny Bilbrey.
The first time I interviewed Kenny Bilbrey was in August of 2013 on the porch at the historic Highlander Center in East Tennessee. That summer, I had just launched an oral history project called Country Queers in an attempt to connect with other rural and small-town queer folks in central Appalachia, where I live, and beyond. I was frustrated that I couldn't find stories of rural queer people anywhere at that point. I wanted to learn from how other country queers were building lives in rural places. I wanted evidence that we exist in every rural county and that we've been here all along. I didn't have any media training or gear, but I saved up and bought a recorder. And I started interviewing young people I met that summer through the Stay Together Appalachian Youth Project. That's how I met Kenny. In July of 2016, I revisited my interview with Kenny. A lot had changed in their world in terms of gender, and so we sat down in their apartment in Whitesburg, Kentucky, to chat.
Hello, the Reverend Kenny B, a.k.a. Kendall Bilbrey, a.k.a. Kenny Bilbrey. I'm 24 years old. So the last time we interviewed, I believe I was on the brink of almost coming to terms with the fact that, you know, my gender is not what I was born with. I was born female. But upon being able to find sort of like a greater queer community and like the understandings of like, actually, like gender is on a spectrum, you know, that was something that I never had been realized as something that was real. And so once I had that realization and like met more people and they're like, oh, well, I use these pronouns. I'm like, oh my gosh, I feel like that would fit so much better and make me feel so much more comfortable. And so I started using they and them pronouns and identify as, you know, as someone who is transgender and also as someone who does not sort of accept either choice, somewhere in the middle. I guess genderqueer is a way to describe it. But also am looking right now at some options for like different medical transition as a possibility for my future.
We were going to do this one, right? So like, I mean, do you have longer ago memories of like gender in particular? Because we talked about queerness and like coming out in your first interview, but...
Yeah, totally. And I think, you know, when I was younger, I definitely had these feelings of like, well, I want to look and dress like a boy, or I want to have like this like access to like the world that little boys get to live in, whether it be like getting to run around with your shirt off or, you know, peeing outside, you know, just like the things that's like, God, I just want to do that. But, you know, I have definitely have memories of that. And I also like ran around with a lot of boys, like my next door neighbors. And we'd, like, do outdoor stuff, play with Power Rangers, you know, Ninja Turtles, all that stuff. And so for a while, I wasn't sure. I was like, well, maybe I just felt like I wanted that because I was around them or, like, you know, whatever it may have been. I remember even when I was, like, my mom found out that I was queer for the first time, she just asked, she was like, do you want to be a boy? I would almost rather that than... you be gay or whatever. And, you know, I would often seek out a lot of different documentaries or movies or like TV shows, sort of looking for like queer stories. And I remember always feeling like some like strange, like I wanted to watch it, but I couldn't watch it because it felt like something like, oh no, that could never happen, when it would be the stories about trans folks.
Do you feel like you want to talk at all about like access to health care for gender nonconforming people in rural areas versus urban, or just whether it's versus urban or not, just like what that's like in a rural context? Because I think, you know, we mostly continue to hear more stories from cities where it's still hard, right?
Totally, yeah. I mean, first of all, I would add that access to quality, affordable health care for any person in this county and in so many rural areas is horrible. You know, so many people don't have access to health insurance. There's very few doctors. So I think when you add like specialties or like different things that people aren't used to navigating into that, it becomes like this huge like emptiness. Like I struggled for a very long time to find a physician that I felt very comfortable with just as a primary care doctor. And there's a nurse practitioner in town, I won't say her name, but she has taken very good care of me. And so I'm lucky to find this one person in this one place, but she still doesn't have resources or education on these. She's been willing to be, you know, very kind to me and patient and like trying to figure out where she could refer me to or whatever. But it's still like, we could send you to Louisville, which is like 4 hours away from here, or Lexington, which is 2.5, or Knoxville, which is 2.5. You know, it's just like all these solutions that, you know, yeah, maybe it would be possible for me to be able to get out and go to that every now and again. But I'm lucky enough to be a person who has a full-time job and health insurance, but so many people don't, and that makes it even more difficult. And I just got an email the other day that there's a trans health clinic that's opening one day a month in Lexington at UK. It's like, sure, you can be trans and queer in the mountains if you have a car and health insurance and access to this or that. So I'm really lucky to have a lot of those in place, but not everybody does.
Since the time of this interview, Kenny has left Eastern Kentucky. They now live near Knoxville, and part of the reason they left was to move to a place with more support for trans and gender nonconforming folks.
That was Kenny Bilbrey speaking with WMMT's Rachel Geringer. Marshall University in Huntington, West Virginia is one school that's taken steps to be inclusive to LGBT people and those questioning their identity. They even had a store where transgender students can get free clothes, but as Roxy Todd reports, at least one person has experienced discrimination on campus.
Lock us in when you leave out.
Marshall's LGBTQ plus office is located in a central campus building down in the small corner of the basement. There's a comfy lounge area with couches, books, and a TV. The students meet here for occasional support group meetings or just to watch movies and unwind. In a back room, there's a walk-in closet with hundreds of dresses, suits, pants, and shoes arranged on hangers and shelves. A full-length mirror hangs on the door. There isn't a men's or a women's section, and that's intentional.
We are in our trans closet.
That's Shantae Polk. She's the director of this office and also leads the Center for African American Students. This is the campus free store for students who identify as LGBT or are questioning their gender or sexual identity.
When you go into the store, are you getting looked at or judged? No. And they shouldn't either.
And all the items here were donated by students or people in Huntington.
We have things like necklaces and scarves and shoes and bags and nail polish and makeup, all clean or brand new, swimsuits, sunglasses. We have everything. If you can dream it, we have it possibly in here.
There are other free stores like this in cities and universities across the country. But LGBT advocates in West Virginia believe this is the first of its kind here. Polk identifies as straight, but she says she's an ally of the LGBTQ community and a Marshall grad herself. Through that lens, she can see that the school has come a long way. She remembers what she describes as a culture of discrimination against LGBT people 15 years ago when she was a student here, including stories of gay couples being ridiculed for kissing in public.
Nobody was really out and proud. And now I can walk out on the plaza and I see students holding hands, students with their rainbow shirts or pants, because we make a lot of pants and it's often them buttons.
Then in 2015, an assault on a couple near Marshall shocked the community. Marshall football player Stuart Butler was accused of hitting and taunting two men after they were kissing publicly in downtown Huntington, not far from campus. Butler was a star athlete, recognized across the country as a leading running back in college sports. Marshall dismissed him from the team a day after he was arrested. He was charged with battery and with two felony civil rights violations. Butler was ordered to serve 6 months in jail. The case made its way to the state's Supreme Court. But in a 3-2 vote, the justices ultimately agreed with the lower court to dismiss the most serious charges because the state's hate crime law doesn't cover discrimination based on gender identity or sexual orientation. Since the 2015 incident, Shantae Polk's office has expanded its work. It hosted Marshall's first Lavender graduation this spring. Other campuses, like West Virginia University, have similar events to celebrate graduates who identify as LGBT. The office will start a support group for transgender students this fall and do another clothing drive for the transgender closet. Last year's was a success.
It wasn't a bag or two, because it was wall-to-wall clothing. And I'm talking about really nice clothing with tags still on it. And it just makes me very, very proud to say that West Virginia, Marshall, Huntington is moving in a great direction.
But one Marshall student says there's still work to be done. Jo Gates is a transgender woman going into her junior year. She's from Parkersburg, West Virginia. She didn't start her transition until she came to Huntington.
I remember my freshman year, I went to go ask the LGBTQ office if they had any information on transgender hormones, and they just seemed like they were very misinformed about the process.
She says she doesn't blame the office or Marshall. She just wishes they had been able to help answer her questions. Instead, she searched for resources online.
I know that there are taking steps to get better. There are getting more actual queer people to work in the office, but I also don't necessarily like that our LGBTQ office is in the basement. The fact that an office for people's in the basement kind of explains like how visible our issues are at school, because it's like they're kind of hidden, literally.
Gates is a journalism major, and for a class, she made a short film about the dorm floor where she lives. It's Marshall's first gender-neutral residence space, a big deal for Gates because all Marshall students are required to live on campus their first 2 years of school. The chance to live in this dorm, with gender-neutral bathrooms, helped make her transition to being a female much less scary. But this past April, not long after she made the film about how much getting to live in this dorm had meant to her, Gates overheard a remark from a member of the cleaning staff, who walked in while Gates was washing her hands in the bathroom. Gates happened to be wearing very little, mostly just her underwear. She heard the cleaning person talking to another worker in the hall a few minutes later.
And he kept on saying, I just assumed it was a female. And he just kept on saying, you know, I assumed it.
Then Gates heard the other worker explain gender-neutral bathrooms. She pointed to the symbol on the door and said she doesn't like those signs because she doesn't want to run into a transgender student. Gates didn't report what she heard to Marshall because she says she didn't think it would do any good. We reached out to Marshall for a comment on Gates' story. Lakeisha Taylor, Associate Director of Residence Life at Marshall, said, quote, "It is disheartening to hear that a student has had this experience while living with us. We make every effort to be as inclusive as possible and provide our students with a welcoming living environment and experience. This includes providing our staff with education on issues of not only how to be successful in their positions, but also in their interactions with the residents we serve," end quote. Aside from this instance, Gates says she hasn't experienced any harassment on campus. She's been taking hormones for nearly a year and says the transition has been great and that she's happier than she's ever been in her life. She treasures the friends she's made in a support group for transgender men and women. That's organized by the psychology department at Marshall University and not by the LGBTQ plus office. At the support group, she's heard many different coming out stories and realizes that her family situation, though not perfect, has been better than others. And even though Parkersburg was more accepting than some places, she wasn't out as trans in high school. Just for the way she looked, she says she suffered emotional abuse as a teen. The worst was the first day of her freshman year.
It just seemed like there was a memo put out, and it was like, if you see Jo Gates, call this person a faggot.
The experience made her tougher.
Because it's like, God, if you can go to high school every day and people are threatening to kill you and calling you a faggot, like, you can survive anything.
But once she got to college, she says she never faced that level of discrimination. Despite the few setbacks she's faced in her dorm, overall, the experience has been positive. And although she feels like Marshall could be doing more to help people who are transgender, she says she thinks it's getting better. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd in Huntington, West Virginia.
Next up, we'll hear about a church in north central West Virginia where the pastor faced criticism for her support of the LGBT community. You're listening to Inside Appalachia.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
After a pastor in Fairmont, West Virginia, said that being gay was not a sin, her church was kicked out of the state's Baptist convention. But her stance on gays and lesbians created some unexpected unifications for both the church and orphaned Christians. Molly Bourne grew up near Fairmont. She and I set out to learn more.
There's a sign out front at the First Baptist Church. It reads, "There's a place for you here." There are enough pews for up to 250 people, but there are only about 25 regular Sunday churchgoers here. Still, this church has made national headlines. It all started when the pastor, Valerie Giddings, attended a meeting of the city's Human Rights Commission last year. The commission was considering putting an LGBT non-discrimination ordinance on the books, and Giddings was there to speak in favor of it. That raised some eyebrows from a group of leaders in the Fairmont Baptist Association, the local American Baptist group.
That prompted this pastor then to talk to the other pastors in the association. And basically they decided that my church needed to ask for my resignation or they would have to leave the association.
To remain affiliated with the state American Baptist Association, Giddings had to take its stance on homosexuality, not to endorse, celebrate, or affirm LGBT behavior. And she says the problem wasn't that she said discrimination is bad. The problem was what she told two local Baptist pastors later, after the town meeting.
I took it a step further and clarified that I'm also saying it's not a sin. And that's where I really stepped away from their set beliefs.
American Baptist Churches USA, the national organization, does not require this stance. Giddings tried to step down, but her church wouldn't accept her resignation. Then in April, the Fairmont Baptist Association voted to dismiss the church, which means it's also out of the state Baptist convention and no longer has a connection to the national organization. Still, the church has the backing of some religious leaders across the country. On a bulletin board inside, Giddings has displayed cards and letters of support from church leaders and others as far away as Seattle and Morocco. And the controversy has brought at least one couple back to the church. Kevin Aldana was raised as an American Baptist, and he lived in LA for several years, attending churches that were welcoming to the LGBT community. He moved back to Fairmont after his parents passed away and says he looked for a church for 7 years. He and his husband, Sergio, were married in Fairmont in November 2014, nearly a month after it became legal to do so in West Virginia.
We called around to a lot of places and asked him, we said, hey, we saw a banner out front. Did you welcome everybody? Let me explain my situation to you. Well, first, before I explained the situation, they said, yeah, we do welcome everybody. Well, my husband and I are looking for a church. Your husband as in, I said, yeah, we're a gay couple. Well, we don't condone that lifestyle. I said, well, you might want to take your banner down because it doesn't really, you don't welcome everyone.
Then earlier this year, they heard about First Baptist.
If God is a divine community, then we have to work really hard to stay together.
Well, the church is going through basically the same thing that Sergio and I went through. We have always been discriminated against, and we were pretty much cast out. Well, this church was cast out. So now they just feel a fraction of what we felt. There's a lot of people out there who've been hurt in churches and have no desire to step foot back in a church again. And it's, you know, I feel like the Lord brought us here to reach out to those people and tell them, hey, there really is a church that welcomes all. This church has offered me more love than any church that I've ever attended. I mean, they don't see color. They don't see sexual preference. They don't see anybody as any different. They're a loving congregation. And I'll never forget the love that they've given us.
For Inside Appalachia, I'm Molly Bourne.
I reached out to the West Virginia Baptist Convention, David Holm, a minister who represents the Northeast region. He declined to comment. The leader of the Fairmont Baptist Association didn't return emails or calls. And I sat down with Valerie Giddings to find out more about her story and how people are reacting to her position.
A lot of it was negative. A lot of comments against me, against the church, but pretty much the same note over and over about, you know, it's a sin and you can't say that it isn't a sin. That's kind of the repetition of that. I got a lot of support from people actually kind of all over the country, because the Washington Post picked up the little Fairmont paper, the Times West Virginian, they picked up that article. And so people in other parts of the country read that and sent us notes, emails, text messages of encouragement. But the ones that I also heard from gay people, locally mostly, who confided in me their grief. And I already knew, I knew that. But to hear it from so many different people and to understand the depth of it, and the prevalence of it, it's heartbreaking that an entire population of people want to be in a community, in a faith community. They want to have that relationship with God, not just individually, but in the church. And they can't. They use terms like being, you know, having been told that they were abominations, living in the shadows. Those kinds of things are not, I don't think they're at all what God had in mind for us as people. They're just, there has to be a closer, more honest, more open look at this, because what is important is how we treat each other. I know I go back to that, but it's the truth. That's what matters. That's what mattered to Jesus. And that's what should matter to us as the church.
Gittings says she never expected to be an advocate or to teach her conclusions about homosexuality in the church.
But I guess one of the reasons that I continue to speak about it now is, honestly, I knew that there was a lot of grief around religion and homosexuality. I knew that there were, from my own family, I knew that there were people who wanted to be part of a church but had been rejected. And not just rejected, but told in very clear terms that they were destined for hell. For me, it was like, I don't think it's a sin. How can it be a sin? How can I, you know, I'm reading what people write about scripture, and it's, how am I going to reconcile this? And so I read a good bit, and yet, ultimately, I think it comes down to that Baptist soul liberty, which says to me, you have to sort this out for yourself. And nobody else can dictate how you look at this.
Earlier this month, the First Baptist joined a network of churches based in Rochester, New York. It will allow them to keep their affiliation in the National American Baptist denomination. Other churches are also looking at this issue. For example, the United Methodist Church, another Christian denomination, created a commission to examine how human sexuality is taught in their Book of Discipline. The new commission is expected to present their suggestions at a special session of General Conference in 2019. An artist collective called Queer Appalachia formed in 2016 after the suicide of a transgender writer with West Virginia roots. Gina Mamone is a member of the group from Bluefield, and they run the group's Instagram page. The collective also recently released a 200-page magazine earlier this year called Electric Dirt, a celebration of queer voices and identities from Appalachia and the South. It's a collection of essays, poems, provocative art, interviews, and more. Molly Bourne caught up with Mamone at our studios in Charleston.
So Electric Dirt just came out earlier this year. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that. How did that happen?
When we first started talking about making a zine, it it was the idea of a woman, Bryn Kelly, who grew up on the West Virginia-Ohio border. She was 16. I was in school at Marshall, and her family kicked her out. And super sheltered kid, looked in the phone book. The only thing they could find, you know, in the early 90s in Huntington at the time was Marshall University's LGB office. I worked in the office at a work-study job, and one day this kid came in crying, not knowing what to do with themselves because they had just been kicked out. And that's how I met Bryn Kelly, and Bryn Kelly would be a consistent part of my life until she killed herself a few years ago. Bryn was like, I'm going to make us a zine one day. I'm going to make us a zine about where we come from, and it's going to be hysterical. And when she passed away, it was like, maybe we should make that zine. Bryn deserved a footnote. To come from where she came from, to make the kind of art she made at the level she made it on. And her work always focused on her roots, which were HIV-positive trans hillbilly realness.
Can you tell me what the title refers to?
We were playing around with ideas for titles, and Electric Dirt was one that everyone responded to, no matter where they were from. It didn't matter if you were from the mountains of West Virginia or from the red dirt of Georgia. Everyone had this profound connection to the land, this land that won't claim them, this land that doesn't want them, this land that passes laws that polices their body and their gender and puts their life in danger, and they still have this intense connection to this concept of home. Through social media, it's kind of become this really kind of interesting catch-all colloquialism where I'm just like, hey, send me pictures of your electric dirt. And it's enough of a wide pitch that it really is astounding to me, the things that people send in, that what electric dirt is to them.
Some of it's really funny.
it can be.
What do Appalachians who identify as queer face that queer people elsewhere might not?
The opioid epidemic here really does change through a queer lens. All of the resources that are here for straight people really don't translate to the queer community in the same way.
You are starting an online resource for people.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about how that's going to work?
We're building a peer-led digital community space online for queer addicts that are living at ground zero of the opioid epidemic in Appalachia. Our plan is to have about a dozen sponsors, people that have at least 4 to 5 years plus clean time. We have a social worker and a therapist that are going to be admins and moderators. So ideally, even if you can't get to a meeting, you can come to one online and you will definitely be able to get an e-sponsor with us. Someone that has at least 5 years clean or more, a rural queer that's willing to drive to you once a month for an in-real-life interaction.
Tell me what you hear from people. I sometimes see on your Instagram stories screenshots of messages people have sent to you, reaching out, thanking you for your presence. What sorts of audience engagement do you have?
We hear so often, it's just like, I didn't know it was okay to own this part of me. It was something that I had to hide at dinner parties. And we've all met those people, and they go into their West Virginia stereotype jokes about teeth and cousins and shoes. And we all get trained for that in the world. And it makes us defensive, and it makes us kind of have shade on where we come from, because it's impossible to not be from this place and to see so many things wrong with it. But that doesn't make it any less home, and it doesn't have to be this huge positive or negative thing. It's just part of you.
That was Gina Mamone speaking with Molly Bourne. Queer Appalachia hopes to roll out the first draft of the online support group later this summer. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We'll be right back. On today's show, we heard stories that seem to point to a time of transition, when people are looking for ways to be themselves comfortably in society, and society more and more is looking for ways to understand, accept, and be welcoming. You know, when I spoke with Pastor Giddings, she pointed out something that isn't often thought about anymore, that at one time Christians used biblical references to justify slavery and racism. This idea is now considered absurd and is rejected. We still have work to do, but hopefully we're on our way to understanding each other exactly as we are. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. Music in today's show was provided by Kaya Cater, Sam Gleaves, Ben Townsend, Caldwell Country Musicians, Spencer Elliott, Dinosaur Burps, and Michael Howard. Molly Bourne was our guest producer and web editor. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. Ivy Caputo edited our show this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. You can find us online on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. If you'd like to listen to any part of this episode again, don't forget you can subscribe or download all of our stories on iTunes, Downcast, wvpublic.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education and more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
And ain't we brothers too? Job and worked right by you. Walked down in that hole beside you. Thought I heard some whisper sound. Got found out, word got around. Got made out for something I'm not. Called everything but a child of God. Didn't mind to show it out in the parking lot. So I cut my coat with my head hung down, just like a stranger in my own town. Got bitter day by day, went home every night with the mess they made.